Let's go.
Welcome to Micromobility, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of lightweight utility vehicles. Using the history of computing as a framework, we examine how these technologies will upend everything we thought we knew about the future of urban transport. The host of the show is Horace Dedu, founder of Asimco.com, and I'm his co-host, Oliver Bruce.
Hey team, Oliver here. This week I interview Rickard Broms from Sweden, who is the founder of Vassla. Vassla won the recent Micromobility Riders' Choice Awards for Best Subscription Company, and I've been following along with what they've been doing for a while. I really love the new pedal e-bike that they are bringing out, not to be confused, as you might hear in this episode, with the standard throttle bike that is similar to the Wheels Shared Mobility Design from California, the sort of smaller wheeled one. My mistake. Either or, I really love the space of subscription services in micromobility and how they lower the barriers to entry. As you'll hear, Vassla started actually as an e-moped company and was one of the few that has pivoted across to bikes and is now growing quickly across Europe. I really loved this conversation with Rickard. He's very mission-driven and has a really good eye for the industry and for where design might contribute. I'm really looking forward to watching what they do in the future. And with that, here is Rickard.
Let's go.
And welcome back to Micromobility. We have with us today Rickard Broms from Vassla. How are you today, Rickard?
I'm doing very well, except for the gigantic snowstorm we have in Stockholm just right now. We just got a hunch of spring coming and then backfire snow blast again. But other than that, very well.
It's so fascinating. Climate change is one of these things that's sort of upon us, and yet, you know, there's snow in LA, there's giant snowstorms in Sweden.
Yeah.
We've had a crazy summer down here. We've had giant cyclones and anyhow.
Something funky.
Totally something funky. Yeah. Well, hey, look, I mean, that's probably leads us on to, like, you know, I know that you've been thinking about the climate thing, and that was in part the motivation for you to go and launch Vassla. But, like, can you talk me through those very early days a little bit about, you know, how you kind of came to start the company in the first instance?
Yeah, I think it goes, I mean, for a lot of entrepreneurs, it's some kind of sequence of randomness or luck or what have you. And I think it was that in, you know, the same situation on my end. I started Vassla back in 2017, and it was basically just for solving my own issue. And the issue was that, you know, it just took me too long to go to work. And one day I just had it. I just completely had it. Just, I couldn't stand another day waiting for a bus that didn't show up, or and myself in congestion, or, you know, having this unpredictability in my daily commute just drove me crazy. And I was, you know, living the consultancy life, super busy, had some kids at home, never knew when to come, you know, to come to meetings, never knew when to come home, miss dinners and stuff. So one day I just bought myself an electric moped, and I realized two things. First of all of a sudden it took me 14 minutes going to work, and it was 14 minutes, you know, every day. No matter of traffic, weather, I just always went on that moped. And it was a crappy lead acid electric moped, but it took me to work. And the second thing was that it was kind of hard to get an electric moped. And this is, you know, fairly developed Sweden just a few years ago. And that surprised me. I had no background in the mobility industry. So I was just completely clueless. I didn't, you know, run a moped, you know, when I was 15 the last time. But it was clear to me that was a lagging or a sleeping market that was definitely just lagging behind. So kind of the combination of solving something very serious, which is making day life more efficient for people by saving time, in combination with the sleeping market, kind of got me going. So we started as an e-moped e-commerce brand.
Yeah.
And we became the market leader in Sweden, you know, the first year. So it was, you know, sequence of luck and timing, I guess.
Yeah. And with that, so with the e-moped, you're one of the few companies that I've talked to that have done e-mopeds, by the way. I think it's my failing for not having covered more of the companies in the space. But the sort of story there, I think, is why do you think it has been so underdeveloped in so many of the OECD countries?
I mean, I think it's a tiny market. The moped, I think personally, I love the moped. So I still run the moped, even though we have an e-bike now. But I very much like the moped because you can have a big helmet. So I think it is a market thing. I mean, it's a tiny market because it's a vehicle that is, you know, limited in speed, but you need to ride it with the cars, meaning it's not really for everyone because it's kind of scary to, you know, be in front of a big truck, you know, slowing them down, being in the way. So that makes the market smaller. So I think a lot of, you know, people are looking into the e-bike industry because it's, I mean, it's 10 to 15 times bigger. So market opportunity-wise, it's a bigger market. However, competition-wise, it's also more competitive. So, I mean, we totally will see 100% electrification of mopeds, no question. But it hasn't really started, you know, in Spain, France, Italy, very little electrification has happened so far. So I think the opportunity is still kind of big. The second thing is the vehicle itself. It's kind of a complicated product.
Right.
I mean, it's heavy certification, type approvals. You need the registration plate, and that process is different in all markets. So it works in one way in Sweden, where you can, you know, connect yourself to the authorities online. And it works very differently in Spain. It worked even differently in France. So it's I think it's a more complicated vehicle and a more complicated market.
Hmm.
It's probably the reason, I think.
And the vehicle that you ended up selling in Sweden in that first year, was that just you went to China and managed to find an e-moped manufacturer that was sort of doing a product that you thought, oh, yeah, that would sell?
Yeah, basically. So I was in contact with two Swedish guys that has been doing it for 15 years, and they had a lot of knowledge. So they pointed me in the right direction and managed, you know, because there aren't that many manufacturers in China that you actually can buy from. I mean, if you go to the Canton Fair or whatever, there seems to be hundreds or thousands of manufacturers of e-mopeds. But in reality, if you're kind of being in the Western world and you want to sell a premium product, there is, I would say, a handful of manufacturers that you actually can use. And I was fortunate to know these people. So I was directed to one of the good manufacturers in the first place. So the first version, Vesla One, was basically a revamped existing model. So
right.
we kind of took, you know, away a lot of the Chinese-ness and, you know, had a LG batteries or branded batteries. We had a Bosch engine. So we replaced a lot of parts, but all in all, it was more or less an existing product.
And with that scooter, so, I mean, I know you've now sold 5,000 mopeds, e-mopeds, was that 5,000 a year or 5,000 in total for those e-mopeds?
No, I think we're close to 10,000 in total.
Yeah, wow, cool.
Yeah.
And then with that, you know, obviously with that, you decided at some point the e-moped is not enough. You were doing that direct to consumer as well, by the way. That was also an element that I found really fascinating.
Yeah, because I don't know better. So I have no experience right. in working with dealers or distributors, and I've worked a lot of, my past is on the internet. So
yep. That
was my go-to place. I didn't know how to do anything else. So we have always been direct to consumer, selling online. So basically all our mopeds has been sold online, basically none in shops or dealerships.
Yeah, wow. And how did you think about one of the big things that we oftentimes talk about on the show, right, is like the subsequent discussion about, okay, great, so you sell these things, and then how do you think about servicing and that sort of thing? And maybe that is where we are going to end up talking about your pivot towards Vesla Club. But I am curious about the mopeds. I mean, they actually strike me as relatively maintenance-free, right, once you sell them.
Yeah, that is the case, or at least it's very binary. Either you have something, you know, fatal electronic, and then you cannot really do anything at a regular workshop anyway, because it has to do with the e-system or the battery, and then you need to identify which part, and then you need to swap that. And that requires, I would say, some deeper knowledge, or it's just, you know, flat tires or just normal wear and tear stuff that anyone can really fix. So, and honestly, it's not a lot to do. I mean, I still have two mopeds from the first shipment 6 years ago, And I haven't done anything. I just let them be during the winter times. I just bring in the battery. And then when the spring comes, I just put the battery in and they just work. Inflate the tires a bit. So it's very maintenance free, I would say.
Yeah. Fascinating. So then talk me through the e-bike thing, because obviously you subsequently went from mopeds, and at some point you said, we're going to do an e-bike service an e-bike product.
Yeah, and I was pretty, determined not to do that in the early years because everyone was doing it. But then we were at like Eurobike or some fair in Germany. And I always have, some expectations. And I always feel that they are not I'm always get disappointed being in these fairs because I expect to see something new, but I really don't see anything new. And we were wandering around the bike hall of the Eurobike. And it was, so obvious that it's a legacy traditional business where basically all bikes are more or less the same, like frame structures, very much the same. I mean, pipe design, aluminum or steel. And then you have basically the exact same components. Either you have a Bosch system or you have a Shimano system, or you have Tektro brakes or you have Shimano brakes. And we're just wandering around there. Like, there must be something you can do. I mean, if you try to kind of preserve the great engineering of a bike, because it's a phenomenal vehicle, because it's a durable thing and it lasts forever and it's easy to ride. So in its core, it's great engineering. So how do we keep that but try to achieve some differentiation? Like, how can we get something that is more kind of iconic, more design centric, but still more useful? Because I've been trying, obviously riding a lot of bikes, and you have these, commuting e-bikes where you sit comfortable, but I'm also very, very design geeky, and I just cannot put myself on one of these. So I tend to put myself on, a cowboy or some lifestyle kind of bike, but then I end up being too uncomfortable. So I cannot really ride every day because my ass hurts, my back hurts, my wrists hurts. So we try to make something really beautiful, but at the same time, it's supposed to be a purpose-built commuting monster. So I would say like almost 100% of the design vision we put into the Vesla pedal when we started, it's there now when we reach mass production. And that is very rarely the case, because in many cases you kind of, you cut some corners or you compromise down stuff because of cost or because of predictability. But we really, pulled through, and I had some great people in the group with the designer Christian Sansotti, and we had our Taiwan team that really made it possible. And we didn't compromise, I would say, on anything. So we managed to make something very, very useful, very, very Scandinavian. So we don't have any, we have one button, no displays, no cables, no gears. And I mean, that is the purpose of being Scandinavian, but also from a maintenance perspective, the less stuff you have that can break, the less will break. So that is also needed for the subscription model. It's key that you have a vehicle that doesn't break down.
Yeah, I mean, I'll link to the picture of the bike in the show notes. People should really go check it out. It is a very different design. I mean, it's a very fresh take on a bike, and I love that it has all of the things that you mentioned. Really clean design. There are no cables. It also has like a carbon belt as opposed to a kind of a chain and derailleur set and things like that. Can you talk me through, like, when you were designing that bike, were you going, we think we're going to shift this to subscription? Like, this is, we're building this bike for subscription? Or did you think we're just trying to build the best bike that's not going to require us to have to do maintenance? We can do direct to consumer, and then it just made sense later on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a boring answer, but all of that, basically. So first of all, we wanted to make one bike that fits all. So that is also why we're doing this semi-step through kind of unisex frame. We don't want to make like a classic male bike and a female bike. We wanted to make one unisex bike because it feels right from many perspectives, I think. And then secondly, we choose, 24-inch tires instead of 28, meaning the structure kind of shrunk a bit. And it also means that we can cover basically my 12-year-old can run it, but also me. And I'm almost 190 and probably even you. You're close to 2 meters, I guess.
I'm about 190, same as you. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. We can run it comfortably. And that is also meant to be. And then secondly, we made it for ownership. So to me, subscription or no subscription, it's different ways to pay for the vehicle. And what I like with the subscription is that anyone can afford it. So you kind of break down the purchasing hurdles, meaning you could actually offer an amazing premium designed, customized pedal or an e-bike to everyone. So that is the great thing with subscription. And then you have the practical part of it, as you mentioned. It needs to be as close to maintenance free as you possibly can, because a lot of challenges in the subscription model is the less you touch the vehicle on maintenance or whatever, the better. So it's we try to think of all of it, but all in all, we want to make like the best product will always win. So that was the goal, and then we kind of had some requirements that we want to check in the boxes for first reaching, you know, addressing as many people as possible, and then also kind of fitting the business model we were aiming for.
Yeah, and the bike, you know, it is a very distinct and different design. You still manufacture it in Taiwan, but, you know, you wouldn't have gone through the traditional, okay, we're going to go and select a frame and then we'll pick some components and we'll pick some other things that will kind of, all of these things will go together. Can you talk me through how you navigated that and managed that? I mean, did you end up with a very specific manufacturing team down there who could pull this off?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a one-of-a-kind team for sure. But we went the traditional way first. I mean, we wanted to make an e-bike, so we went the classical way, standing in line with all the others, going to Portugal, going to Poland, going to the Baltics, asking them, hey, we want to make an e-bike. You know, what is the lead time? How do we do this? And we got the same reply everywhere. And that was like, yeah, it's fine. Put in an order of, you know, 100,000 units, MOQ, and you're going to have it, you know, in 3 years.
Right.
And we're like, 3 years? I'm not sure if I live in 3 years. We have, you know, maximum 12 months. So that is, how do you do that? I'm like, oh, that is not possible because that is, you know, lead time of that and lead time of that. So we had to kind of do it more or less ourselves. So we put together, you know, the design team, the Sansolti Studio is very, very, you know, not just good designers, but also good constructors. So they did a lot of the engineering and together with us. And then we had a team in Taiwan that was not connected directly to the manufacturer, but kind of was our team on the ground, but has 30 years of experience and knew the entire supply chain. And he just dreamed of putting more e-bikes on the street. So he's very knowledgeable. So definitely, but I wouldn't say we got into any kind of setbacks. I think that the team is experienced enough that we could see like, okay, if we have this frame structure and we kind of make a big hole for the battery, that means that we cannot make another hole on the upper side of the tube, because then it will be too, you know, it would hold the structure. So I think having the experienced team was definitely the key success, but it wasn't really super weird that we needed to go somewhere, you know, specific frame manufacturer that could only do like that. It wasn't, I mean, it's not that funky. I mean, I think that the design and the frame customized for sure, but all other components are proven, you know, components that has been on bikes for years. So we didn't take any product risk in that. We didn't make any kind of, you know, special solutions that wasn't unproven or whatever. We focused on making the design unique and then make the kind of the rest of the supply chain as less risky as we possibly could. And that is also, I mean, maintenance and after service. We don't want to create this spare parts monster where we are the only source for all spare parts. That is, I don't enjoy that. I enjoy kind of doing vehicles and selling them or providing them. I don't enjoy the whole spare parts thing. So the leaner we can do that, the better, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've gone the not Van Moof model in that regard. Like, you've picked relatively standard components that can be switched out in bike shops and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I believe. I mean, it's different strategies. I think there's pros and cons with everything, and it requires certain size if you're doing everything customized. Obviously, you're also building differentiation in all kind of parts of it, but it also requires a lot of you on the aftermarket side.
Mm. And the bike, so that was introduced in 2020, is that correct?
You mean the Vesla?
The Vesla pedal?
The e-bike.
No, the Vesla pedal.
Yeah, it was announced in November last year.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, super fresh. It's not on the streets yet.
Yeah, it is super fresh. Oh, wow. I for some reason, I thought it would have been announced sooner. No. Okay, great. That's marvelous. So and have they, like, they're shipping now and people have them in their hands and enjoying them?
Not yet.
No, okay.
So we have the first two containers just reached shore. So we will start putting them in people's homes the coming weeks.
Marvelous. Oh, that's very exciting.
So it's sold out. The first kind of small batch is already basically sold out. So yep. It's up to us to ship them in time now.
Excellent. And then, you know, subsequently you've gone and done the Vesla bike as well, which is the, you know, it's a sort of seated scooter, way smaller wheels. Can you talk me through that part? Because I think that was when I saw that, it reminds me of the company Wheels.
Wheels, yeah.
Which did with the shared model, using a similar kind of form factor in the US and was quite popular. For a while there, raised a lot of money.
And that's the one, that is 2020. So that was we did the moped first, and then we did the Vesla bike, which is the pedal-less e-bike.
Yeah, catch you.
And now the Vesla pedal. So that is the sequence. And it's a funny thing, you're mentioning Wheels, because when it was the same thing, I was bored on another German fair, I don't remember which one, and we were wandering around, and we saw that vehicle because the Wheels vehicle, it's based out of an existing product. I don't remember the name. But I saw that and I'm like, that is kind of neat. Like, it's tiny, and I've been in China a lot of times and I've seen kind of the process of, you know, when I was there the first time, all the mopeds were big. And when I was there the last time, all the mopeds were small. So it was an obvious kind of trend that everything was just getting smaller and smaller. So to me, that kind of seated scooter or pedal-less e-bike or what you call it, 20 kilo mini moped, it was interesting. So we tried actually to purchase that one to try it out. And we got, you know, some vague replies from the manufacturer saying, maybe can we speak in another week or two? And then all of a sudden, Wheels was launched. So they bought it just 1 week ahead of us, that exact model.
Wow.
So they started also with that.
Yeah, wow.
I think they modified it and made their own version of it at some point, but they bought kind of the rights to that vehicle just under the nose, under our nose. So we had to make our own one. So we the Vesla bike is a really customized vehicle. We did everything ourselves in that, because there was nothing existing on that form factor wise.
Yeah, wow. I mean, it is it's fascinating as well, because it's a sit down scooter and it is not a bike. How is that classified in a lot of Europe? My understanding is that would that be like a mobility scooter?
It's complicated. No, it's like it's different. So it's different layers. So on an EU level, the rules are pretty easy to understand. So everything with pedals is some kind of bike, and everything without pedals becomes some kind of motorized vehicle or moped. So in our case, we became a moped on a lot of markets, and it goes for Wheels as well. We in Sweden, everything with 250 watt engine and the top speed of 20 kilometers per hour is treated as a bike. So in Sweden, we were treated as a bike. And in January last year, France introduced a new vehicle definition, where they gathered scooters with seats and e-bikes without pedals. So overnight, we became a bike also in France. But in Germany, we are a MOFA, which is a slow moped.
Yep.
And in Spain, they only have one moped definition, which is, you know, the regular 45 kilometers class one moped.
Yep.
And what that means, it becomes complicated. Like you're not welcome on bike lanes. That is learning, you know, the hard way.
Yeah.
That is the crucial factor. Like being with cars on a really slow vehicle, that is not for everyone. So for that reason, we made a Vespa pedal also, because at one point, I'm 100% sure that all government or authorities will just wake up and look at cars, where you have big cars, you have small cars, but it's still a car. It's just in the micromobility industry, we tend to kind of define skateboards, bikes, mopeds, scooters, and put names on all of these vehicles. But I mean, in general, they're just the same vehicle. They're just light and small. So just call them a light electric vehicle, and they can just be treated the same way. That is how it should be, I think.
I understand the pushback. I mean, I see the you know, if you're riding along on a bike lane, and all of a sudden someone zooms past you on a 45 or 50 kilometer an hour moped, like,
yep,
you'd probably complain, because it does feel dangerous, especially if you've got an 8-year-old who's riding along next to you or something like that. But for something that's a sort of small form factor sit-on scooter with small wheels, and it's you know, it's going 25 kilometers an hour, that feels, you know, you're in the same same class, really.
I mean, also, I think this is probably this isn't Horace's idea, or I probably heard it from him, because every all the insights in the micromobility industry comes from him, it feels. But I mean, yeah, in the car world, we just have, you know, it's not the top speed that sets kind of how we can run it. You have signs, so you have speed signs, you have all kinds of signs that regulates where you can ride it and how you can ride it. And in the micromobility industries, we tend to limit everything with top speed. Like, I totally agree with you that it's not good if you have a 45 kilometers per hour moped running on a tight bike lane where you have, you know, unprotected, and you have trolleys and everything. But if there's, you know, narrow and very little room, just have speed signs. Maybe the spandex guys, the ones biking like at 50 kilometers per hour, maybe they should also be cautious on these kind of passages. And when it's protected and wide, then you can allow people to go faster.
Yeah.
And then you can basically allow everything. I mean, I think we will always have that discussion. I mean, a cargo bike, you know, cargo bike, 60 kilos, you have two kids in them, you have some groceries, that is also a pretty heavy vehicle that is allowed. And then you have all these, you know.
Totally. And if it hits you, yeah, completely.
Yeah, hybrids of, you know, pedal cars almost, that are more, you know, the way as a car, but you pedal it, so it becomes defined as a bike, which doesn't make sense. So I think weight is more of a better kind of definition than if it has pedals or not. That doesn't really make sense, I think.
Yeah, completely. So you've taken you've obviously got moped, bike, pedal. You are now looking at, you have got the subscription service, and congratulations, you were, you won the Writer's Choice Award for top subscription.
Thank you.
In the inaugural Writer's Choice Awards that we had with Micromobility World. So talk me through that element, the subscription business and what you've built there, and why you think it's so compelling, why you were able to win that Writer's Choice Award.
Yeah, so it's multiple factors. So first and foremost, it's about accessibility, because I think an e-bike, the average price of an e-bike in the whole of EU is 1,700 euros, I think, which is quite a lot, meaning it's kind of just wealthy people that can get access to premium or good e-bikes. And that thing needs to change, I think. I mean, if we want the mass adoption, if we want to change the cities for the better, you know, accessibility need to increase. And I mean, shared systems and all of these have kind of opened that lid, but I think the ownership product also needs to change, and business model wise the subscription model makes a lot of sense, because normally you have some kind of public transport card or some kind of, you know, commuting fee anyway, and if you can stay within that range and you can offer them you know, the public some freedom and a great freaking e-bike and full access to it, and it sleeps at home. I think it's a pretty good value proposition. And then it becomes a little bit different than selling, because all of a sudden you're not selling a product, you're selling basically uptime. So it requires a different kind of operational setup, because if you are subscribing on a service and you're dependent on them, on it for, you know, your daily commute, and you run into a flat tire, obviously your uptime is going to get hit by that. So we need to be able to fix that flat tire fast, otherwise you will not get to work. So that requires, you know, an operational setup that is not unlikely the shared systems, I would say. You need local operations on site, you need mechanics, you need operational specialists. So in general, the reason we're doing it is the accessibility. Also, competition-wise, when we're breaking into this e-bike land, it's a highly fragmented, competitive landscape where you have 1,000 brands doing some kind of e-bikes. But there aren't 1,000 brands doing e-bike subscription. And to me, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I don't think it's a huge kind of product or business model risk into that. I mean, the bike is a validated product. The subscription model is a validated business model from entertainment and streaming. But the combination is, it's kind of new, which makes it kind of exciting.
And with the, you know, with the launch, so you haven't done the subscription on the bike, or you have been doing it on the bike and you're going to be launching it on the pedal, obviously, when the pedal comes.
We have done it. We have been live in Paris for about 8 months with the Vesla bike.
Right, right. And what's the sort of cost that you're thinking for different markets for the different products?
So we always use the public transport kind of monthly pass as our kind of reference. And we try to stay in line with that. We don't want it to be much more expensive. But we also need to have a sustainable business. So it's we try to stay in that range. That is always the goal. And that's going to look a little different in EU compared to US, for example, where it's slightly more expensive in the US, for example, or and salaries and cost of living in general is higher.
Yes, yeah. And then, so with the, can you give me like a euro figure for what the bike subscription cost is in, for example, Paris?
So it's 79 to 99. So we have three different plans. Either you subscribe on it month by month, which is called the Flex plan.
Yep.
And for that, you need to pay a little extra, 99. And if you hook yourself up for either 6 months or even 12 months, it's going to be a little cheaper.
Right, catchy.
So that is how we try to incentivize people not to kind of do the whole car leasing where you're kind of locked in for 3 years. But if you choose to, if you are like a commuter and this model, you know, adds value to you, why wouldn't you subscribe for 12 months? And it gives a lot of comfort to us on the business side, but it also gives a lot of comfort to the financing side. Like because you want to finance your vehicles, and meaning you're using your vehicles as a collateral for a loan to pay, you know, purchase vehicles. And basically what you're having as a collateral is the vehicle, but also the cash flow from the usage of the vehicle. So it's I would say it goes both ways. It gets some more predictability and some more comfort in the model, but it also kind of gives comfort to lenders for the asset-backed financing or equipment leasing funding.
Totally. So that's actually the next bit I wanted to discuss with you, because I think this has been oftentimes done not particularly well. One conversation I've had with the team at Lug & Carry in Australia was very enlightening, because their background is in asset financing and equipment financing. And I think that we've done it inefficiently in the market in the past in order to be able to get it to market. Because there hasn't been lending markets available for these sort of things.
Yeah.
Like you just didn't know, right? So you put these scooters out and people are oftentimes buying them with equity rather than shifting to a proper asset financing. So with you, have you developed all of your own subscription, all of the kind of back end and the financing? Did you develop that all yourself? Because I also know that there have been the emergence of services in Europe that do hardware as a service for subscriptions, where you can effectively go to them and they help sort all of that stuff out for you. How did you manage that part?
We will definitely kind of assess that opportunity, because it has a lot to do with, I would say, two factors. First of all, the vehicle. Like, if the vehicle doesn't break down that much, then the need for local operations is less, meaning it will put less load on the model. If you have more of a, I mean, we try to rent out vehicles to delivery drivers, for example, which is a really, you know, a hard task, because they're using it 10 or 20 times more than the usual. So I have very hard seeing that model really work out, honestly, because you need to service the vehicle so often that, and I mean, the delta between what you can earn and spending cost is really difficult, I would say. So we have done it ourselves, and we will continue doing that in our key markets. And then we will definitely explore the potential of working with vetted, very reliable partners we know, because that's going to be very consumer facing. So you cannot really just set up some floaty partnership with a car workshop. I think that's going to be very difficult, because the customer will be suffering from that. But I think there is a lot of good e-bike kind of maintenance services out there. Jepley is really good, I think. Get e-bike service. So they are emerging, and they really get it in another sense than the traditional way. So I'm not ruling that out. We will definitely continue kind of experimenting based on the insights and the data we will get from the vehicle. But I definitely see that as a potential solution to kind of make the operations more lean.
Yeah. This still feels nascent, the subscription space for this. I mean, I think there's a whole bunch that the industry is going to learn over the next, you know, year to two years.
Yep.
About what works, what doesn't work, how do we make these things viable? But I'm with you in the sense that I think the size of the market is just so much bigger than if you just sell them direct to consumer, because of the cost up front, but also the knowing that you've got the support around you when you own this vehicle, where it's kind of new and everybody's learning.
Yeah, and a matter of generation where, I mean, we're probably in the same or similar generation where we're in two worlds. We kind of are used to owning stuff, but we kind of really enjoy the, you know, streaming, subscribing on stuff. But then you have the generation kind of younger than us that haven't really experienced owning stuff at all. They don't want to do it. So I think the only way to address that portion of the audience is definitely to make some business model innovation.
Completely. So I want to talk, pivot a little bit about the funding, because I think you've raised in total $17 million, so a little bit less in terms of euros.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that to me is, you've obviously managed to build a couple of quite interesting products. You're not a giant Van Moof or cowboy in terms of the sense of having raised hundreds of millions. And you know, I'd just love to hear your take on the journey of like starting with a business that was just importing and bringing in mopeds. And then obviously you built a business and then you have gone off and built other things off the top of that. You know, what's that journey been like for you for raising? Has it been hard? Has it been easy?
Now we have really, you know, seen two markets, that's for sure. I mean, in the early days, it was easy to plan. I mean, it was much more kind of easy to foresee. You could, you know, spend your money, and then a couple of months before you ran out, you could just, you know, start another fundraise, and you will have, you know, 95 or 99% you know, of success rate. So that will happen. Nowadays, I think you should be really, really, you know, have some respect to the current market, because it has changed, and I don't see it going back anytime soon to where we are when, you know, the cost of cash was zero, you know, because it's so many layers. You have LPs and you have lenders, and if it's free for them, and all of a sudden you have, you know, the governments, you know, the interest rates and stuff. So it becomes a more complicated system. And I think the less in the future, the way I see it is being as little dependent as we possibly can on external venture capital. That's the route we're going to take. because I think that is the only way to actually get some venture funding if you choose to. But having that option, if you need venture funding or if you can just sustain on your own, I think that is the position at least I want to strive for. And when it comes to total financing, we basically have two needs. So we have the business and we have the expansion that should be covered by either your own capital or some venture funding somehow. And then we have buying vehicles, which is just a liquidity bridge. You need to, you know, you need to have vehicles in order to rent them out or to sell them. And then it's different payback times depending on the model. And taking equity money to buy vehicles is very, very expensive because dilution is the most expensive money you can ever get. Yes. So we will, I mean, I started maybe 1.5 years ago to kind of explore that scene. And I see a huge difference. I mean, 1.5 years back, basically, I didn't, you know, met anyone that kind of was willing to or understood the dynamics of financing e-bikes. It was like, you know, e-bikes, what's the residual value of an e-bike? You know, can you pay back, you know, is it, are you paying down 50% in 3 years? Or, you know, how long will an e-bike last? And you have seen the scooters, and it was like a lot of uncertainty. But I would say recently, the appetite has gone up significantly, probably because a lot of people have seen the explosion of growth in e-bikes. And the bottleneck for everyone, including us and including, I would say, all the companies that do e-bikes, is going to be financing or liquidity. And the one who cracks that is going to be even bigger than the than us and the e-bike companies, because that's going to be a huge business. So I definitely see appetite, understanding, constructions that really works well with the subscription, you know, the equipment lease back solutions. I mean, this has been done with, you know, trucks and cars and
tractors and everything. I mean,
all sorts of equipment for tractors forever. So it's basically the same model, but you just need to understand kind of the data, the residual values and durability and stuff. But that's going to happen for sure. I mean, we have term sheets done already, so that's definitely going to happen. And that allows us to fundraise smaller because the total need is and I think we see that all over the place. I mean, it's always some combination of depth and equity nowadays for hardware companies, and that's the way to do it. And even better is to be profitable so you can be bankable, and then you can access cheap depth instead of expensive depth.
Yeah. And what's your, I mean, in your view, what, how much time is it going to be before you are profitable?
Yeah, because we have seasonality. So we kind of have this bell curve revenue still. We're working on becoming less season dependent, but we will be season dependent for this year. So we will have some profitability this year, definitely on a monthly basis, but not on an yearly basis.
In the sense that you're seasonal because people buy the bikes only in the summers,
exactly.
But then they don't buy bikes in the middle of winter in Sweden. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah,
I mean, e-commerce and subscription, those models works really good together because the subscription gets you recurring revenue, but it takes some time to kind of build it up. It's a back-heavy business model, and the e-commerce business creates cash flow, and you need that too. So if you combine them, that's, in my opinion, kind of the best blend, the way to kind of get to profitability faster, but still have the element of recurring revenue. And for us, we're making very little difference of that. I mean, it's up to the customer. We're sending the customers into the same exact funnel. And if you want to rent it, you're fine. If you want to buy it, it's fine too.
Do you earn the same amount regardless of whether or not they buy it or they rent it? I mean, I take it at the end of the day, in theory, they say, I want to rent it, and it comes off the back of, you would get reward. Your asset finance provider would, in theory, just pay you out for the bike at the time anyway, and then they take it off and handle that part of it.
No, I would say subscription model gets you more revenue. Like on a total basis, you will definitely earn more money on the subscription model, but you get less cash flow because it takes more time to get access to that revenue. But if you manage to run the model well, meaning you can rent out your vehicles for multiple years, and then, you know, a 2 or 3 year old e-bike, it's not scrap. It's far from scrap. I mean, Look at Upway. If you buy a three-year-old cowboy at Upway, it costs like 1,700 euros. So the residual value, the secondhand value.
Oh, what's Upway? I've never heard of Upway.
A French secondhand e-bike company.
Oh, no way. Okay, yeah. Oh, I should go track them down.
Yeah, they keep popping up. That's also a very exciting market, the secondary e-bike market. Imagine all these. I mean, in Germany, you have Jobrad, and you have all of these kind of where you buy the vehicle out of salary deduction.
Yeah.
And in the background, there is a leasing solution for that. And there's going to be shitloads of leasing e-bikes out there that at some point needs to be sold.
Yes.
And that's going to increase, and it's going to be pretty easy to predict. And that is also an interesting business.
Yeah,
you're going to see a lot of, I think.
I think so. Whoever nails that is going to be really... it's actually, there's been a little bit of exploration in that that I've seen from the US, where a guy called Puneeth Maruva, who's an associate at Trucks, has been...
Flywheel.
Yeah, has been writing Flywheel, and he's going and like scraping Craigslist to be able to pull out all the data about the secondhand market for e-bikes. But even that is like, you know... The quality of the data that we get on that is not great.
No.
You know, like the thing that's kind of crazy to me is that these things, you know, like at the end of the day, you should be able to easily access and get all of the data, and it should be verified of the bike and how it's been used, and if it's been involved in a crash, or if it's been repaired, or the number of kilometers it's done, all that sort of stuff. You should be able to get all of that off a bike. And then you'd know, I mean, it's like the data should sit there. I mean, and then you'd go, okay, great. We can build really comprehensive secondhand markets for this.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it should be specialized in e-bikes, because if you're just buried in Craigslist or any local kind of secondary marketplace, it's not being done properly. I think there will be definitely some emerging secondhand data-driven marketplaces where you can either you hand in your used e-bike and, you know, you put in your serial number or whatever, and then that data is going to be translated into some kind of standard template value or whatever. And then there's going to be all the connected vehicles where you will have even more data. They will be like cars. It's going to be very easy to value them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting opportunity. And I think also with the increase of subsidy-driven, salary-deducted paid e-bikes, where you buy it as a benefit out of your salary. I mean, Jobrad in Germany, that's huge in Germany, and it's huge in Sweden as well. But it's a really great way to buy an e-bike. Just have, you know, slice off 50 euros or whatever from your salary, and you don't even see it, and you get access to a super good e-bike. And it's feeling is that it's almost for free because you hardly notice it because it's already deducted before you get your salary.
Yeah. The what are the things that you get most excited about in the micromobility industry? I mean, you've been around since 2017. You've obviously been thinking about this for a while. Like, what looking ahead, what are the things that you think, oh yeah, I can't wait till that comes?
I mean, I'm not really on the technical side. I mean, I think, you know, e-bikes right now is all about hardware. It's going to be in the next phase about user experience. So it's going to be about the combination of software, hardware, IoT. Definitely, that's going to happen. And it's going to include safety, theft protection, and make e-bikes even better, easier to track, harder to steal. That's going to happen for sure. And that's not too far off. But I think the thing that really kind of excites me is that we don't need any new technology to make huge impact, because what we see on the environmental side, I mean, 37% of all CO2 emissions is caused by the transport sector, and it's growing. So it's not decreasing like every other sector is decreasing its CO2 emissions, but the transport sector is increasing. And a lot, I mean, 78% of that is caused by road traffic. And, you know, 83% of all car trips are below 15 miles or 25 kilometers, and they're all exchangeable to some kind of small vehicle. and no charging infrastructure is needed. No new roads are being built. Batteries are good enough. Engines are good enough. Brakes are good enough. We just don't need anything more than just people to change their behavior just slightly a bit. It doesn't mean you have to sell your cars and never drive a car ever again, but the car is very well suited for long trips, and it's very badly suited for short trips. And I, you know, maybe I'm biased, but I think that is the only way we can kind of turn the trajectory is if we address the short trips. And it's a really, really simple solution to an extremely complex issue. Like, and we've tried to solve it now for 20 years by trying to improve the car and make it electrified and
biofuels and all that sort of stuff.
We build roads and tunnels and a lot of that things that will not change anything because they're just too big for short trips anyway. It doesn't really matter if it's driving automatically, if it's electrified or whatever. Just use an e-bike. And I mean, I think that is what I'm terrified and excited about. I mean, SUVs shouldn't really be allowed. What's the bloody point of running a Jeep in the city? Just use an e-bike. And I hope that the coming generations will, I think SUVs will be kind of a shameful vehicle, honestly. I don't think it's not going to be a status vehicle at all. I think, you know, being independent and being kind of sustainable and riding your bike, that's going to be the status going forward. And what happened the last year, I would say, is that more people than us, the companies, start to realize that. I mean, Paris is a good example where Anne Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, is extremely determined to kind of block cars from the city center of Paris because that's the only way. I mean, you cannot make it better for cars. So the only way to do it is to make it worse for cars. Take away parking lots, transform car lanes into bike lanes. It's kind of an easy transformation, honestly, because it's not much needs to be developed. We just have to change our behavior just a slightly bit. And I think that's happening now. I think it's really happening. I see that in all big cities. I mean, New York is getting rebuilt for humans and bikes and trees and benches instead of building roads because it's just a trap. It will not take us anywhere. I mean, we have been doing electrification of cars for 20 years now. And I think the overall adoption for electric cars is 13%. 13% of all new cars are being sold are electric. And that's nothing. Like, and we've been doing it for 20 years. It's going to take us 50 more years, I think, if it happens.
Yeah. Especially to get to scale, right? I think that's we might get to 100% of sales, but even that'll take a while. And then it's the, okay, great. That's 1 year of sales, but you've got 20 years of cars to have to work through, you know? So.
Exactly. Every single diesel car we put out there lives for at least 15 years. So
yeah,
it's just going to be dragged on forever, I think.
Yeah. Well, hey, Rickard, thank you for this. It's been enlightening and fun. And I was really, really chuffed when I saw that you had won the Writers' Choice Awards for subscription. And I thought, oh, I definitely have to have you on. Because I have been, you know, intrigued by the bike that you had done. And I'm very excited to hear about how that goes. Hopefully, we'll see you at Micromobility Europe in June if we can.
Definitely.
So it would be, folks can check out the bike there, and I'm looking forward to riding it myself. Yeah. Well, hey, thank you, and I'm sure we'll have you on at some point in the future again to talk about some of the other new things that you've got coming down the pipe as well.
Happy to. Thanks for the chat, and thanks for everything you do. I think you're more meaningful than you think. You know. giving us ammunition and insights. So you're doing a great job. It's very valuable.
Well, that's the aim. That's the aim. Yeah.
Happy for that.
Marvelous. Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.